While we're just sorting out the slides, can I just ask people, I'm interested where people are from, because I often feel that we end up preaching to the converted when we really need to get some commissioners and policymakers on board. So can you just put your hands up if you're from the third sector? So there's quite a few. Any policymakers here? Just, and any commissioners? Okay, that's promising. There's a handful, that's good. First of all, very quickly, because this isn't in our presentation, what we'll probably do is whiz through a lot of the slides, because I think sort of Helen's covered a lot of it already. But gypsies and travellers suffer some of the worst health inequalities in the country. You know, I mean, just very quickly, we're looking at up to 20 years less life expectancy, 3 times higher infant mortality. A gypsy mother is 20 times likely to lose a child before they reach maturity through accident or illness. So some big, big health inequalities. We had a project. We were funded by the Department of Health up until recently, but they haven't funded us, or lots of other organisations working on inclusion health. But we were running a project which was part of Inclusion Health, which was trying to get the needs of gypsies and travellers into joint strategic needs assessments, really for the reason that Helen has explained, that if you don't have that data, if they're not included, then how can commissioners commission a service? And what we've found, you know, Inclusion Health produced some really good guidance. You know, fantastic, but what really causes me pain is the fact that it's no good having guidance if you've got nobody operating the machinery. You know, it feels to me as if it's like having a really well-equipped factory, but there's nobody making that machinery work. And actually, you know, what worries me about the lack of funding and support for people working on the inclusion health agenda is that that guidance will just sit on shelves. You know, it's what we found in our work was that, you know, like Helen was saying, in their audit of joint strategic needs assessment, but actually where it tended to work was where it was being driven, and often it was being driven by a third sector organisation lobbying. We were sort of phoning them up, what have you done? What have you included? A lot of the time they didn't know what to put, you know, so they were very dependent on us being able to provide that information. As I say, we are no longer funded by the Department of Health, so obviously the job's done, but that's another story. So how do I make is it just okay, and I'll jump there. So the cycle of exclusion, which I think sort of Helen has really touched on, which is very sort of similar. Poor ethnic monitoring leads to a lack of data. There's a focus on geographical health inequalities, which with localism, you know, so we're all in our own little sort of silos looking at our local needs, which sounds great until you have a very big issue that is national and not, you know, they're not, in a sense, collectively, we could drive that agenda. But when you're talking about very small samples of a local population, it's very hard to get those needs measured. So that's the cycle of exclusion. Health inequality duty. There is a commitment, or there was supposed to be a commitment, for people to identify the needs of local people. Again, I think sort of Helen's touched on it. You know, there are marginalised people are often just pushed even further to the margins, and that actually can be a danger of localism. Right, well, I'm going to whiz through the slides because I think we'll be in danger of repetition.
Looking at, in 2011 we had the census, and it's the first time that gypsies and travellers have been put on the national census information. Basically, there was an awful lot of underreporting. People did not still feel very happy to reveal ethnicity. I'll give an example. In Brighton, 194 people revealed their ethnicity as gypsy or traveller. But these are specifically people who were living in bricks and mortar accommodation. And they were obviously in a position where they felt comfortable enough and safe enough to do so. I can give an example that I can just pull a figure straight away. A new site's being built in Brighton for unmet need. We've never had a permanent Gypsy Traveller site. The site opens in June. It's taken us over 12 years to lobby to get this, get government money, fight lots of local opposition, local politics, etc. In that site alone, we have what we call 70 people moving onto that site. Not one of those people is on that census. But they will be regarded as resident of Brighton and Hove. Although they have travel status, they continue to move, they've been evicted for every couple of weeks around the area, out of the area, back into the area. That's where they were born, that's where they live, that's where they call home. They are local people. So it's interesting to see with the NHS, they promised in the data dictionary to update it to include gypsies and travellers. They haven't as yet. I think they've updated it in Scotland, but that's it. It's still not updated. And one of the things that we do within our organisation as well is try to get people into health services, as most of you will do here. And actually, it is possible to put local codes on and put gypsies and travellers on it in a locality. And I know that they do that in Bristol. I know that that doesn't happen in Brighton, for example. I've been talking to the CCG. I've asked the equality leader at the CCG to do that, and they're looking into it. Because we know we have a lot of patients or clients going into services, and it would be a very good way to actually measure how many gypsies and travellers are using that service. Going down to ethnic monitoring, it's not just the categories and forms that will improve it. You have to take into account the discrimination that's already faced by a lot of marginalised groups, particularly gypsies and travellers. And without having the confidence to put in your ethnicity, we're not going to have those solid figures that we keep on getting told we need to get any funding or to get included in any type of health inclusion or whatever, education, etc., etc. But when you're facing double discrimination or prejudice, you're constantly getting evicted, you have a fear of children's services, etc., etc. It is very difficult to encourage people to actually, reveal their ethnicity. I clearly take a lot of clients into surgeries, and they'll put down, rather than putting down Irish traveller, they'll go, if I put down Irish, I'll get treated better. So again, we're still in this situation, and people are still very, very uneasy about revealing ethnicity, and it's quite easy to see why if you look what's going on in Europe at the moment, etc., further discrimination. So that's a problem. So it's really, again, about investing in building cultural competency with surgeries, with other, with healthcare professionals, and also with other statutory services. And that's something that we continue to drive as an organisation. We're driving constantly about investing in cultural awareness training, understanding, listening to gypsies and travellers speak, etc., and constantly putting out reports and trying to disseminate that to people to improve that that trust.
Okay. Again, sort of inclusive joint strategic needs assessments. I think Helen's said that it's about, you need an accurate picture of the demographics. You need sort of health and social needs. There's a lot of sort of hidden needs. Again, gypsies and travellers are the best people to give us that information directly. The next slide just goes on to the kind of information that should be included within a good joint strategic needs assessment. So I'm whizzing through these because I think they're probably what people have got the idea.
Okay, with gypsy and traveller people, classic again, people are experts in their own health, they certainly are. To actually get the information from your different areas, from your different localities, it's really important to engage with other gypsy traveller organisations or leaders within the community, for example. We have got lists on our own website, and if you work with traveller people, it's probably the best way is to go in and try to encourage peer interviews, etc. Look for people within the community that you possibly could train up as well. There's been a lot of success in health training programs with gypsies and travellers. We do programs like for the RSPH2 as well about improving its understanding healthcare, etc. So when you're looking to, you know, get some inclusion in those JSNAs, it's really important to start with the people themselves and get the forums going, get the conversation going and build up that trust, but use someone within the community if at all possible, if not get some advice from someone like FFT, and so you're not actually just excluding people. So, you know, there we are, the cycle of inclusion, which is the completely opposite. So, robust and inclusive JSNAs. This would be the perfect example of how you get a good inclusion going. Commissioners recognising inequalities in access to health outcomes in their community. What I will say, in Brighton itself, I do work with the CCG, and I work very hard to get some money from the CCG to from the commissioners to actually keep gypsum travellers on the agenda. So I'm part of the Health Engagement and Qualities Group, and I am there day in, day out, going out on assertive outreach and looking at what the problems are within the community, what issues they have, and as a result of that, I'm actually gathering intelligence from gypsum travellers using case studies, using comments, using questionnaires, etc. At the same time, payoff is that I will do casework for people. So I've got a trusted relationship with local gypsum travellers and resorting gypsum travellers as well. And that enables me to actually prepare reports and feed it back to the CCG with so gypsum travellers' health needs don't fall off the agenda. And as a result of that sort of work, I've managed to do reports and get, again, some things changed. It might be little victories, but it's been taken into account. And I think I'll come to that a bit later on. Oh yeah, so it is influencing it. I've managed to, one report, one of the first reports I did, and one of the first engagement jobs that I had was looking into urgent healthcare needs for gypsum travellers. And it's still very shocking that people are not able to register with a GP. And it's the same old, where people are saying, well, you haven't got an address, I'm sorry. We can't. You'll have to go to the walk-in clinic, or you'll have to use A&E, and it's that, you know, gatekeeping from surgeries. So I've managed to actually go out and do some training within surgeries and also tell them what actually the law states. And very recently I've got to meet Jeremy Hunt, which I'm sure you'll be delighted to know, and I put this to him, and he was very surprised that people were still not getting able to access because they didn't have a residential or a permanent address. So I have a letter here from Jeremy Hunt, which explains very clearly that that is absolutely not the case, and that anyone can register from the point of first point of access, which you can download from our website. And I encourage all my clients to do that and take it into the surgery with them. And as soon as they see that, they immediately register them. So that's really important, because you know what I found in the past, when you train surgeries and you continue to do it, surgery staff change. So it has to be a rolling programme. If you're not completely and constantly rolling out that information for people, it's very exhausting, because you'll send a client down to go to a surgery and then you'll get a phone call, they've just told me to go, they can't register me. I'm having to go, right, hang on a minute, I'll phone them up again. But this is a very, very weighty piece of thing, so I think you can download it and go straight to the surgery, and then you watch the receptionist change her mind slightly. Other things, you know, about that that duty, we were able to produce and distribute health cards, because a lot of our clients haven't got any literacy or any perhaps understanding, they need support, etc. So we were able to produce a health card with the CCG, which is very, very discreet. It's like a wallet size one, and they can pass it to the receptionist. So if there's any form filling or anything like that, they will tick the box at the back saying, I have a problem filling forms, or, you know, I need help to do this, or I'd like to see, you know, a same-sex doctor, etc. So there were, like, you know, a couple of things that have really, really been important. And on top of that, I like to think that I've done a report on health checks, which of course is a massive issue. Again, if you're not registered, you're not going to get offered the health check, and that also comes into things like the cancer screening programs as well. So many of our clients will never, you know, get the offer of any screening programs, especially things like the bowel screening program, where you need to be in a place where you can actually go to the toilet. Most of our clients live on unauthorized encampments, therefore they have no toilet facilities, therefore they cannot go
right, I'm going to go to the toilet and then I'll go again in 3 hours' time because it's just not possible. So all of these things were sort of have been taken into account by the CCG. As a result of some of the work, I've just done a report on hidden incontinence within the gypsy and traveling community because of lack of basic sanitation, and which you can look at on the website again. And it's got a very good cost-benefit analysis, and the savings to the NHS should local authorities, public health and CCGs come together and just provide very basic sanitation for encountered gypsies and travellers. We've got reports on the urgent care, attitudes around record sharing, which is an incredibly interesting one because, of course, some of the comments from there, people still remember the Second World War and are very, very reluctant to actually put forward they were gypsy or traveller because, of course, so many of them, or so many Roma, actually were murdered during the Holocaust. So there's some very interesting reports there which you can look on at on the website and continue on that. So.
Just the challenges, really, for, I think, for all of us working on any kind of inclusion health agenda is... What we've noticed, of course, is that austerity impacts directly upon the most vulnerable people in our society. I mean, I'm hearing, you know, that other organisations working with people are having their funding halved, axed. It's we can't do our job, if we're not there to do it. So, you know, I sort of think damage limitation. You know, how can we minimise what's happening, and how can small organisations remain intact in order to do this? We are a small organisation. You know, FFT has about 14 staff, half of which are part-time, and we're a national organisation. There's only a handful of us working on this agenda. What I think, you know, the way forward is that the challenges that the different clients that we represent, whether they're street homeless or gypsies and travellers or sex workers, are often that, you know, there is a fundamental core which is to do with inequity, with inequalities, often around poverty, you know, think Michael Marmot, around health literacy, around access. I think that we need, you know, most of us, the people that we are working with, are actually quite traumatised. I would say that many of the most vulnerable members of the gypsy traveller community are traumatised. They are evicted on a constant cycle. We're working with people who are living with a lot of domestic abuse, a lot of mental health problems, a lot of, you know, they don't have access to employment in the same way as other people. They need access to coordinated healthcare. You know, it's if we really want to change this, we have to get sort of social care and healthcare sort of integrated, which is what we keep talking about, but we often don't see it happen for the groups of people we're working with. So, you know, there is a way forward. You know, I was trying to think, how can we achieve this? First of all, and, you know, we have it in the Constitution, public health is supposed to be doing, we are supposed to be reducing health inequalities. If we're going to reduce it, you know, the people at the very bottom are just falling further down the ladder. So if people are serious, if commissioners are serious, then it needs to be funded to stop, because it's going to get worse. There needs to be more collaboration and partnership working. We will disappear. The small charities will disappear if we don't work together, you know, collaboration and partnership working, because, as I say, the issues... access, health literacy, you know, they're not that different. So we should be looking, rather than sort of, you know, getting charters for sort of working street homeless or gypsies and travellers or this group or that group, we need commissioners to start thinking about inclusion in a broader sense, you know, to start looking maybe at some of the, you know, vulnerable groups of people. Perhaps we need commissioners to think about how they will get inclusion onto their health and wellbeing boards. So that's the challenges that we would like to throw out. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's open the discussion to the floor. We only have 15 minutes. Who would like to start? Any comments, questions at the back? Let's take two at a time.
It might sound like I'm trying to pull us a bit off.
let's take the gentleman behind. Can you say who you are and who you work for?
Listening to Professor Wilkinson this morning, he was about people bigging themselves up, so I'll not try and do that. I'm Grant Lockett. I'm from St. Ledger Homes in Doncaster. And really just thinking about a number of things that have been said. In terms of the Health and Wellbeing Board, Chief Exec of St. Ledger Homes and I both sit on the Health and Wellbeing Board. And we've managed to get homelessness and housing into the JSNA and also into the Health and Wellbeing Board, and we report into the Health and Wellbeing Board. The challenge, and I know that Zoe picked up then on the how bit, is I'm responsible also for Gypsy and Travellers within Doncaster, which is one of the highest populations of G&T in the country. But we also, from our point of view as a company, we accept that, or we recognise that there's still that accepted discrimination against Gypsies and Travellers, and certainly in some of the things that we do. So you've covered a lot of the why, which we know, because we're banging that drum. The bit that we still struggle with, even at chief exec level and at my level as AD, is getting the Health and Wellbeing Board and public health partners to accept that there is actually some need that needs to be met with G&T. So although Zoe covered some of the how, it's more of the practical how from either yourselves or peers in the room of how we actually do that at local level.
Michelle, do you want to do the first one?
Okay, I'll just look at about the relationship with Gypsies and Travellers and Roma. It's interesting. Many Roma that come into the country will not reveal that they are Roma. They'll say, I'm Czechoslovakian, I'm Romanian, I'm from Macedonia, because they suffer with such extreme discrimination in their own sort of host country, as you would call it, that often they won't reveal. But interestingly, as time is going on, and it's strange, I had a call yesterday from one of the London boroughs, from another Gypsy Travel group, and they were asking some advice because they've been invited by their local authority in the city of London to come in, because they are now meeting Roma who have decided to go and become more mobile. And in the past, Roma have lived in sort of housing and in poor accommodation or on the streets. But they're actually now getting caravans and driving. So there's quite a large encampment of Roma who had never used that in their originating countries. And they're actually spending a lot of time with Irish travellers as well. And the Irish travellers are offering them work. And, so there's a definite change in the environment of what's going on. I think one of the problems at the moment is, Roma, they're an ethnic minority, they're protected exactly the same way as Gypsies and Travellers are if they are, from an ethnic background. I think realistically, I mean, we do work with Roma. We work with the Roma Support Group, and also there's a church in Luton as well, which have done a lot of Roma support. Very similar issues in an awful lot of ways. However, I think it's just going to get bigger and bigger. And the biggest challenge on that, obviously, is language. Although some of our staff speak Romanes, it's difficult because there will be some element of being able to speak Romanes, but also, you're going to have different languages, Czechoslovakian, Hungarian, etc. So that's the one big issue. But I do see it as, a lot of Roma people in the past as well, some of the Romans have been quite interested and fascinated by Gypsy and Traveller culture in this country, comparatively to the country that they've left, because they find the word, for example, the word Gypsy, they find that, a real insult, because the way the word Gypsy was used as, a ne'er-do-well, a scoundrel, sort of vagrant. So they find it very strange that English Gypsies or Romans like to use the word Gypsies. And so there's a lot of, there's a lot of commonality within the three different groups. There's a lot of differences too.
And just very quickly, the second question. I think it is a major challenge. The how bit is always the difficult thing. I think that, we have got these two reports on our website which might give you sort of some clues. But I think, really it is that thing about uniting. I think that we need you know, not just gypsies and travellers. Obviously, the thing about many gypsies and travellers is actually they are homeless. Mm. This is something we share with Helen's work. Mm. So, you know, I think we need to be working much more creatively and be working together, and then I think we will be able to have more influence on the health and wellbeing.
Mm. Yes.
I mean, I think that's probably why when the Inclusion Health Programme at a national level, when it was active, it was very helpful, because I think it recognised that, you know, separate interests saying the same thing have limited impact. And obviously there are specific issues for each, you know, each group of people and the people within that. But as you said, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of commonality as well.
Thank you. John.
Hi there, my name's John Neal. I'm with the Pathway as part of the EB team. You have two questions, if that's all right. A quick question.
The
Brighton site from the Leeds. Was there any more? Are there plans for any more? But more importantly, how is it welcomed and received within the Gypsy and Traveller community? The second question is regarding the letter from Jeremy Hunt that you got. Is that Gypsy and Traveller specific, or is that for people who fall under the NFA action?
It says Gypsy Traveller MoMA Access, but actually the letter is quite generic, so you could actually use this for any type of, you know, person that's actually, you know, it mentions here hostels where appropriate, so yeah, you could use it quite generically. So that takes that one off. I'll just answer. So you're interested to know how the site's been.
Yeah, welcome to receive within the actual Gypsy Traveller.
They're absolutely delighted. I've got clients within that site who have been travelling, who have had nowhere to call home, have been excluded, really been told by the Brighton local authority and business, etc., etc., that they're not from Brighton, when actually their children were born there, etc., etc. This is the first time for some of them in 20 years that they've had a place to call home. You know, if you look at gypsies and travellers over the centuries, of course, you know, the nomadic lifestyle was absolutely integral to life, because you'd move according to your work patterns, the family would work together, etc. But over modern, you know, since factory farming, since modernisation, since local authorities have sold off pieces of land and car parks, the areas that people can actually travel without getting evicted, like to traditional stopping places or transit sites, it's near impossibility. So actually now, you know, they're absolutely delighted that they have got a permanent site from which they can live, and while still maintaining their traveller, you know, background by having their touring vehicles as well. So it's been so hard fought to get a site in Brighton. Fortunately, we've got the transit site at the site too, but there's still quite a large unmet need within the city. So, you know, there's a lot of very disappointed gypsies and travellers within the city that haven't had their needs met yet, who are still going to be in that merry-go-round of evictions. There's been a lot of local opposition as well, as you would imagine, in a lot of places. Building a new site is something that people are, you know, people sometimes think, my goodness, where have they all come from? They've been in Brighton, or gypsies and travellers have been around for centuries, you know, and as in other parts of the country. And I think, you know, this is the point about discrimination and being the last acceptable form of racism. And I think that's an issue.
At the back and front.
Thank you. I'm Angela Burnett. I'm from Torture. I just wanted to echo what you said about different groups really uniting different experiences, but similar experiences of exclusion. And just to draw your attention to this guidance for commissioners about commissioning mental health services for vulnerable adult migrants, which I met with Johannes Fassel, and you can find it on the Mind website, and it's been launched in a couple of weeks' time. But really, to say that how effective it is when service users have actually used this guide to engage with commissioners around their intentions, and this was done in Harrow. And just to say, just a few of the lessons that they learned, which I think are perhaps of universal relevance. Firstly, sort of taking time to develop the relationship and create a common language between service users and commissioners. A aim for transparent decision-making using national policy and guidance, and also using expert patients being able to describe their experiences and really bring things alive. And one of the commissioners can say it's probably quite a sort of dry experience often, sort of creating documents, and to actually have that lived experience is really important. And then monitoring outcomes and real-life experiences. So, yes, getting things in the JSNA, and then where after that it's a sort of ongoing monitoring. So thank you.
Thanks, Angela.
Hi, my name's Jo Clark. I'm the nurse practitioner and homeless pathway team at King's College Hospital. It's more of a comment really rather than a question, but King's College Hospital is based in the London Borough of Lambeth, but the boundary to Southwark literally runs down the side of the hospital. In Southwark, I know of two fixed traveller sites. In 18 months I've been in post, I have not had a single referral for a traveller patient in hospital. And I don't know whether that's because you're not telling me there hasn't been a traveller admitted to hospital in the last 18 months. There must have been quite a significant number because they're two big sites. I don't know whether it's because travellers arrange to have care of addresses, so they just go into the system and appear to be housed. Whether it's because they've got a postal system that looks like a fixed address. And I certainly don't think the hospital asks about ethnicity to do with traveller status. Because I've had one referral that was a Roma traveller who'd come from Romania, but certainly we've had no British-based travel referrals.
Sorry, did you say you were a health visitor attached to
hospital? No, I'm a nurse practitioner.
Oh, nurse practitioner, okay.
I think that's something that's really becoming apparent, because you've mentioned that people don't like disclosing, but how can we encourage people to disclose?
I think on the Southwark site, one of them's definitely a permanent site.
On
the unofficial site, what I would imagine some people do, and I know this is what I've found in the past, is they've used an address.
Yeah.
You know, someone that they know who might be in housing. So you'll find there's about 25 people registered in one address to get, because they've, you know, unless they've got that support to actually go in and say, well, actually, I don't need to have this, they'll find ways around it. But an awful lot will just go in A&E services, and that's the sad fact. And we know what the costs are to that, and that is the bottom line.
The irony of the one Roma referral that we did receive, we only knew she was Roma because a Romanian member of staff went to translate,
okay,
and the Roma woman didn't speak Romanian.
She spoke Romanians, yeah. Yes.
So
you wouldn't have known otherwise, and I think, you know, it is tricky to get people to ethnicity. They've got to be in the right place, or they've got to have the support to do so. So if you've got some, you know, outreach workers from places like FFT or other organisations, they're more likely to build up a level of trust and then feel happy to reveal. But it's not always the case, I will say that, you know.
Just as a sort of postscript to that, but I often use this this example, but a lot, I mean, this, and this was about health visitor, but I didn't hear you, was, a long time ago we went and asked, this was when there were still PCTs, we asked health visitors, are you seeing gypsies and travellers? Can you tell us how many you've seen in the last 6 months? And they said, well, we don't mind them, they're very welcome, they can come to us. And actually, there had been four contacts in 6 months, and I think that was in Hastings and Rother. And actually, at the same time, we were managing a health visitor, and we had 127 contacts of assertive outreach. In other words, you know, if people weren't coming to us, we were going to them. And actually, there was a lot of need.
Hi, John Islis, from Julian House organisation based in Bath but working across the South West around homelessness and exclusion. Firstly, kind of just an example really to kind of really corroborate some of the stuff that's been said by friends, family and travellers. We have a small gypsy and traveller service as well, working with boaters, working with gypsies, travellers and new travellers as well. We very focused on health inclusion and health promotion, so we wrote out to all the GP surgeries within Bath and North East Somerset to try and see if they wanted to do any kind of training around kind of cultural understanding and awareness and sensitivity. Well, those that actually wrote back to us, and some of them were just like a scribbled note on a kind of return of our envelope, really, saying no. A couple of them actually thought that we should pay for them to attend training rather than something they might actually value and get something from. Anyway, that's just a kind of corroboration of a lot of the problems that I know you face. But the other is really a comment around the kind of commonality of smaller organisations and exclusion and health exclusion. Be it homelessness, be it gypsies and travellers, be it sex workers, be it migrant workers and asylum seekers, the commonality is lack of housing, lack of security of tenure and somewhere to live. And that influences everything. It creates the health inequalities. As we heard this morning from Professor Wilkinson, you know, these are not the causes of poverty, they're the symptoms of poverty. They're the symptoms of the problem. And so kind of we really do need to join together, share our information properly, and kind of get these issues onto joint strategic needs assessments.
Thank you. I'm just going to ask actually just on what you were saying about identification of homelessness, people who are homeless at hospital, because people give addresses at hospitals.
It's quite interesting. When they did the joint needs assessment for Kings for the homeless pathway too, they did the usual searches for Rough Sleeper, NFA. And then when we went live, we got a bit of a shock because of the amount of people that put false care of addresses, but they're not identified as care of addresses. So we thought we were going to get this number of referrals and one of my biggest bugbear at King's is that nursing staff seem to have forgotten to ask people about their housing status. Mm-hmm. And then until they get to the point where somebody's medically fit for discharge, they'll go, right, you go home now. And the person says, I haven't got anywhere to go. So I'm doing a lot of education, a lot of rules, naming, trying to get people to actually ask the right questions.
At FFT, we've got at least 40 clients who use our business address as a care of address to get
and
health services.
The other problem we have is that people think hostels are permanent accommodation.
Yeah. And I think this is about sort of the ongoing monitoring and the information they collection, isn't it? Because if you've got JSNA, it's like, how do you keep on top of that? You're saying staff change, so how much training
you're
doing, unless it's actually built into people's systems.
I'd be very happy to see the CCG bring in some sort of quality mark as well around training for groups that could come together to say that we've had this training and we're going to keep up to date with it, because we're constantly feeding in the data to the live document, which is the JSNAs, and which what goes on. And
it's about explaining the importance of the data, because staff often see it as a chore when actually it has huge implications in terms of the quality of the support you can provide to people, including whether there's continuation funding or not.
Yeah.
I just think going in from there, because I work in public health and I have carried out a number of health orders looking at the health needs of people at home as well as sleeping. When we looked at an area of Devon where there is quite a high traveller population, I think I was quite interested to include those people within the audit, because some people, that might be a choice in terms of lifestyle, but also given the high rents in the area, it might have been because that was the only alternative they had. But actually trying to, I felt that I was actually getting some barriers from the organisations that work with those groups as well, to say, oh no, you can't come and talk to them about that, they'll be suspicious. And I wasn't, and what I did in the end is I got a colleague that I knew worked in homelessness who was a traveller, and I actually asked her if she negotiated and got a seconded to go and do that piece of work. But I think there is something about how we collaborate and how we get that message across about the value of why we're collecting the data that we're collecting, and that to get rid of some of those suspicions, because that, it's really nice to see you, Zoe, because I've read a lot of your stuff, because it is some of the only stuff there is that gives us a kind of evidence of need around the health needs of this population. And actually, there's some real barriers, I think, for us to try and get other information. And I wonder if we were sort of trying to, do our little bits and add to a bigger whole with that as well.
Sam, at the back.
Just very briefly running on, just see what the cultural competence package training involves. So maybe there's a downloadable package, because I can put my hand up and say that our team, the team I come from, I think the team, tried to get access to the Egyptian traveler community in Southwark and failed.
Right.
So I would we need training rather than anything else.
I mean, FFT can provide cultural competency training, and we obviously we work with local gypsies and travellers to deliver that training. It is available.
It's what the actual.
Yeah, it's training for brief.
Do you want me to go on?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've done quite a lot. I mean, it depends what organisation is. You can bespoke it according to your needs. So, you know, if it's, for example, you know, a basic background of, we'd start off with different types of traveller, might be within your vicinity, the issues. For example, if we were training to a housing organisation, we might look at some of the issues that often come up with housed gypsies and travellers, i.e. a lot of discrimination. You might get reports of noise. You know, you might get reports of lots of cars coming in and out, they're leaving their trailer there. So we'd look at the issues and explain, you know, around the background to gypsies and travellers, and, you know, how, you know, often someone that's coming in from bricks and mortar, for example, who might never have lived in bricks and mortar before, but has been forced into housing because there are no sites and health, you know. So it would break down into lots of areas. So we'd also, you know, look at the local locality, population, and what types of travellers you have there. It can be quite bespoke, really. I mean, when I go out and train, like, surgeries, it will be things around, you know, a lot of the time doctors will say, "This, but they're so chaotic. They come in and there's, like, four or five children and they're really demanding and it's upsetting all my other patients." And it's like, well, this woman has probably not been into a surgery for the last 10 years. This is her opportunity. This is her one moment where she wants to see you. And also, she wants you to see her children and get as much as she can, because she might not see you again. She might not see anyone again until, you know, she has her next child. So it's just putting things into perspective and saying, you know, often gypsy travellers might talk a little bit louder. They may not have the literacy. Things that people might not even consider. So it does depend according to what audience that we would train. It's bespoke according to, you know, training needs, really.
Thank you. I think we're going to have to start wrapping up, and I think that the three key themes that really came across are data, and if there's no data about the problem, then it doesn't exist. So it's just incredibly important to collect better data about the problem. However, many groups are very hidden, not just homeless people, but even more gypsies, travellers, people because of cultural reasons. Lots of discrimination, they may not want to disclose they belong to those groups. And the importance, especially at the time of austerity, of working together across different silos, because sometimes we're talking about the same people, but we're using different labels for them, either homeless or gypsy, refugee. Sometimes we're talking about exactly the same people. John, do you mind me bringing you in, whether you have anything to add? No? Okay. In that case, let's carry on the conversation of the lunch. Let's thank our speakers.